Well, the Sisters of St. Anne were running the hospital when I got there in 1961, and they must have had about six or eight sisters working there, some of whom were cooks, some were ward helpers. The director of nursing at the hospital was a nun. And they were there, well, the both years that I were in Dawson, and in 1963, they finally got really mobilized and they bought a brand new station wagon, and the director of nursing was the only one that was allowed to drive the station wagon, and she was probably the world's worst driver. And she brought the station wagon into Whitehorse on a trip. This was just after I left in June of 63. And going back out, this was in July probably, she rolled the station wagon and was killed. And they'd had a really tough time running the hospital for the last few years because they'd had trouble recruiting people to go into the order. They'd had trouble. They had, like, the parent order was in Victoria, and the main convent was in Victoria, so they had to send people up from Victoria to Dawson, and it was pretty difficult. You know, it was a real transition from Victoria to Dawson. And of course, a lot of the nuns that they sent up were old and were infirm, and the winters just about killed them. And they lived in the house that was the governor's old house there in Dawson. I don't know whether you've been to Dawson, but that beautiful colonial-looking mansion that was next to the RCMP. Well, that was the convent. They lived in there. And the whole building was used. They had the bedrooms on the second floor, and they had their living quarters and their chapel and everything on the first floor. And they had a beautiful vegetable garden out back, and they really kept it up. Although, you know, that nobody could run a hospital or a house as cheaply as the nuns could. They were just fantastic. I don't think anybody's ever operated the hospital in Dawson as economically since. They were really, they had, well, must have been six or seven while I was there. And they worked like galley slaves. They looked after that whole house. They did all their own snow shoveling. They had a maintenance man at the hospital, but they did absolutely everything. You know, they looked after the garden, they looked after the house, they looked after the cooking, and the nun that was in charge of cooking at the hospital, granted she had some helpers, but she prepared the meals. And they fed people like myself, that were sort of their star boarders, and one of the RCMP fellows always ate all his meals there.
Did you live at the convent?
No. I lived over the liquor store.
Oh!
Right above the liquor store, in the teach reach was up there, and the public health nurse's apartment, it was one room, and the liquor vendor and his wife, we occupied the whole second floor of that building. And my office, my quarters were directly over the office, which was right wall to wall with the liquor store. And the walls were so thin that, you know, at 5 o'clock you used to, well, the liquor vendor was a really nice fellow, and used to knock on the wall about 5 o'clock, and he'd say, "Are you finished work for the day?" And I'd say, "Yes." And he'd say, "Well, guess what? I just broke a bottle of 999, you know." So I couldn't get in there from the office. I had to go outside and up the stairs. We used to whip into the back of the liquor store, and before I went up for dinner, there'd be two or three of us in there having a drink of 999. And then from the back of the liquor store, you could go up the back stairs right into the tea tree. You didn't have to go outside again. Mm. But it was a tremendous place to be. Boy.
What happened to the sisters then?
After the Sister Superior was killed, as I say, it took the heart out of the whole operation. She was really the moving force. Her name was Sister Ignatia. And when she died, the whole thing collapsed. There had been talk up till then of the territory taking over the hospital, but nothing had ever really been done because it was a headache. You know, where was the territory going to find staff? And at least with the nuns, they sort of had captive staff. If they were already in the order and they got posted to Dawson, they looked upon it as their calling in life, so away they went. But you weren't going to recruit staff like that for the territory. After Sister Ignatia was killed, the territory appointed a delegation, one of whom was this Jean McDonald I was telling you about. And they went up to Dawson, And they went over the hospital with a fine-tooth comb with a view to taking it over. And they did ultimately take it over. The territorial government took it over originally, then the federal government took it on from there. I can't remember exactly how long the territory ran it, but it wasn't very long. And then ultimately the federal government stepped in and built it. Well, they didn't even stay in the old building that long because it was just a monstrosity to heat. Whenever the river came up in the spring, the basement flooded out and the boilers flooded out and the whole thing. So they built a complete new nursing station there, and it's been open about 5 years, I guess, 5 or 6 years. And now the staff is all recruited federally. And the nuns left Dawson. I'm not sure of my dates here, but I think they were pretty well all gone by the end of 63, certainly by the spring of 64.
Oh, was that late?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, they were still there when I left in 63. They just bought this new station wagon, and they were still there, and Sister Ignatia was still the nurse in charge. But she was killed in, it was either July or August of 63, about 20 miles out of Whitehorse on the Dawson Road. And she had a woman from Dawson with her. I can't remember, I think this woman was employed at the hospital, who wasn't hurt at all. It was just a freak accident.
Mm.
But that did it, really, as far as they were concerned. They closed the order down. They still have their order in Victoria. They still run a convalescent home in Victoria. Because I can remember taking a patient from Mayo out there to this convalescent home that the Sisters of St. Anne were running. And it was just treated like visiting royalty because I was from Dawson. Just great.
Maybe I'll try and write them. I went to the Sacred Heart Cathedral and talked to the father there.
Probably wouldn't know that much about her.
No, he didn't. And I ran across in the archives some correspondence about the Mayo Hospital with the sisters. They were originally contacted to run the Mayo Hospital.
Yeah, they never ran the hospital while I was there. The hospital was always run by the territory in my time.
Yeah, they turned it down.
Yeah, they couldn't staff the Dawson Hospital. They had a terrible time staffing the Dawson Hospital half the time.
But they were based in Lachine, Quebec at that point, so they must
oh,
have changed.
Oh, and this is a way back.
Yeah, so I'll see if I can.
But it's the Sisters of St. Anne,
right.
And they run a convent in Victoria with a convalescent home, and now to the best of my knowledge, they're still running it. I can't tell you the name of the convent.
Sacred Heart.
But there must be some of the sisters out there. They also used it as, it was also their retirement area, so there must be some of the sisters out there who worked in Dawson, because I can't remember names now, but I know that two or three of them that they had there were really quite young.
Mm.
They couldn't have been much older than I was, and I was in my early 20s at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't be, they'd maybe be in their early to mid 40s now.
Mm.
So they would remember.
Right. Were there many people using the hospital? Because now that there's no real hospital there at all and everybody comes to Whitehorse, if it was used as a hospital back 10 years ago, was there that much need for it?
Probably as much need then as there is now, because the population really has stayed pretty well the same, except that they've now got Clinton Creek people coming in there, say, you know, although they have a nursing facility at Clinton Creek, it would still do something as far as the number of patients in Dawson, because there's so much traffic on the road back and forth to Clinton Creek. But they had a lot, really. They had a lot of pediatrics cases. They had a lot of obstetrical cases that certainly didn't come to Whitehorse. They had a doctor there, a resident doctor.
Mm-hmm.
A Dr. Buxa was there all the time I was there.
And he did surgical procedures there?
Only if they didn't involve the giving of an anesthetic.
Even then that was the case.
This was true anywhere in the territory. If you only had one doctor, he could not do any procedure which involved giving an anesthetic, unless it was, you know, a real dire emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of few and far between even in my day.
Mm-hmm. So emergency cases would be evacuated, what, by plane then,
when you were there? Oh yeah, we chartered to get them out of there. Not too many by road. See, when I was there too, we had an airlines based in Dawson. Connolly Dawson Airways were based right in Dawson. And they had, Connolly Dawson, the chap that owned Connolly Dawson Airways, is the president of TransNorth Turbo Air currently. So this was the beginnings it was one of the backbone charter services in the territory, and they had some pretty fair-sized planes there. So we were never really stuck. And then Klondike Airways were based there too with helicopters. So you had two choices. For sure, in the summer you had lots of choice. In the winter, well, we had a sked run coming in there. Albeit it was haphazard, maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. I've forgotten what the schedule read, but they never really flew according to the schedule. But if it was an out-and-out emergency, we could pretty well always get a plane.
When you say we, were you the only nurse, or was there another nurse?
Oh, no. I was the only public health nurse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was the only field nurse in the area. Consequently, if the doctor was out of town or anything, I was the one that always got called. If anything happened on the highway, or if anything happened out of the town, or if there was even an emergency in the town. But see, as I say, the Sisters of St. Anne lacked transportation. Mm-hmm. And being hospital-based, they wouldn't go out on any of the emergency calls. So that when the doctor was away from the town, which actually he was really good, he was away occasionally. But if he was away, then I took the call. Mm-hmm. And I had to arrange for things.
Did you have a car?
Yeah.
Supplied by the government?
Supplied by the federal government, right. Yeah. Right on the premises.
And what kind of nursing facility did you have?
I had a clinic. Just an office with a waiting room and then an examining room. There were no facilities for anyone to stay overnight in at all. But of course, with the hospital there, I wouldn't keep anybody overnight anyway. Mm-hmm. The only people I ever kept overnight was prior to welfare getting in there. I used to get involved in welfare, you know, with mothers taking off and leaving children alone all night, this sort of thing. And I used to bring them home to the teachers, and the teachers looked after them. They were really great, you know. They didn't matter what I dragged home, they always bathed them and cleaned them up and kept them there overnight till we could find a place to put them. But as far as bringing patients in overnight, I never did that. Quite frequently escorted patients to Whitehorse, you know, if they needed somebody to come in, because I was sort of handy. And again, you know, sisters, well, if it was cold or something like this, you know, I mean, they're dressed in their long dresses, and it was pretty awkward getting in and out of some of the bush planes, so they had to have somebody go that sort of knew how to nurse on the airplanes, and they weren't prepared to handle that type of nurse. So if anything like that came up, I'd go on that. Or ambulance calls, I always went in the ambulance call. We didn't really have an ambulance, mind you. It was the RCMP car most of the time, and the RCMP usually had a station wagon. And that was what served as the ambulance. We didn't have a proper ambulance.
Did you have any ambulance call?
Not a great number, because it was pretty quiet then. But you see, the first summer I was there, the Klondike Gold Rush Festival, Dawson City Gold Rush Festival, that was the year that they brought in the play from Broadway with Bert Lahr and the whole thing. And this was sort of the beginnings of Dawson, as the revival of Dawson. And there was a tremendous number of people in Dawson that summer, and there was a lot of highway traffic that summer and a lot of emergencies. And then the following year, after the Dawson City Gold Rush Festival, which was a colossal bust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the town sort of sank into a complete depression. And from there, it was revived again. It's typical Dawson, eh? It's down one minute, up the next. But Saucony Mobil Oil moved in, and they were drilling for oil up on the Eagle Plains and up on the beginnings of the Dempster Highway that was just being started then. And they had quite sizable crews in there for a winter program. So again, you were running into a lot of emergencies, drilling accidents, this sort of thing. But of course, most of these oil outfits, they provide their own support flying, like, oh, there's a helicopter outfit in BC that used Okanagan helicopters right. used to come up and service their camp. So they always have pretty good transportation, and if anything happened, they'd whip them out pretty quickly. And usually the helicopter was based there and brought them into Dawson rather than taking somebody. Seldom did I go out to the camp. They mostly brought them in. I went out once. Oh, maybe more than once, a couple times. But I can remember the summer of 62, I guess. They had an outbreak of infectious hepatitis in the Shell oil camps. And the helicopter came in, and I started off at 7 o'clock at night. And I visited all the fly camps. There was about 11 of them. Way up beyond the end of the Dempster. And spent all night flying through the camps, dispensing gamma globulin as a precautionary measure because the camps were so isolated. And got back to Dawson at about 7 o'clock in the morning, I guess, after having flown every fly camp in the territory.
You think it'd take longer than that?
Wasn't bad. There was just maybe a hop, skip, and a jump over the mountain, this sort of thing. But they were all up on the tundra. And they were just, just a collection of tents, really. They weren't any permanent camps or anything. They were just summer field work, mostly. So they were, in some there would maybe be 4 or 5 men, and in others it'd be maybe 20. But all told, it didn't take very long.
What kind of things did you do specifically for women and children? I guess you had baby clinics and prenatal classes and counseling.
It was preventative medicine. I was there primarily on a preventative medicine basis. Immunization, maternal and child health, school health program, venereal disease control. There was maybe 5 basic programs that I was there to carry out. Although in any isolated area in the territory, Dawson being just one of them, because actually my first isolated area I worked in was Watson Lake, you always found that, as I say, if you were the nurse, like Dawson was fine. There was a hospital there and there was other medical aid there, but anywhere else, like I traveled down to Pelly and Stewart and Granville and these areas, there was no medical help there at all. So I found that when you held a clinic, it wasn't strictly preventative medicine, it was a treatment clinic. In fact, it was probably 75% treatment, 25% preventative.
Mm. And did the doctor go along, or were you just alone?
No, I always did them alone.
How often?
Well, once a month, anyway. At least once a month. Depending on weather, number one, because we were not supposed to drive if the weather was 40 below or colder. That was number one. Number two, it depended on what was happening in the community, too. For instance, I can remember at Pelly there was an outbreak of TB, so I went there 3 times in 1 month. Mm-hmm. You would go down and do tuberculin testing, but you wouldn't necessarily stick around for 3 days to read it. You'd go back in 3 days. Well, it was only 160 miles down the road, so I'd go back into Dawson and go back in 3 days and read it again.
Was the government still running those massive TB testing?
Oh, yeah.
Things at that time?
Oh, yeah.
When did they stop?
You see, they've always really done it. We've always had sort of massive testing, but they hadn't reached the stage where they had began to have the outbreaks of TB again were really more apparent when I came back in 65, 66, 67 through there, when they established a TB control office in Edmonton, and they began to realize that previous treatment had been on the inadequate side, and that therefore a lot of the old TB cases that they considered to be cured were breaking down again. Mm-hmm. And as they broke down, they reinfected the young. And this is where we got the really massive testing programs came back into being. But, even back in 59, 60, We were still doing once a year TB testing sort of thing on all school children and preschoolers, and it was part of the control of communicable diseases program. So you had it all the way along.
But it was done by you in Dawson and by somebody else in Mayo. It wasn't that traveling service.
No, me. I did it all.
Right, because when back in the late 40s, they had a unit that went up and down the highway.
They still did, but the only X-ray. Only X-ray, not the actual tuberculin testing. The tuberculin testing was done left to the public health nurses. Now, this goes back quite a ways. This goes back even before my time in Dawson. This would go back probably to early to mid-50s. And then, in some instances, they X-rayed only the positive tuberculins, or you had a list of those who definitely should be X-rayed.
These are the skin tests.
Yeah. But the public health nurses did all of the skin tests, every bit of it, right through the whole area. Like the area in Dawson extended Dawson, Moosehide. For what Moosehide was, there was three families living in Moosehide when I was there. Granville, and then plus the families up between Dawson and Granville. Excuse me, Bear Creek was quite a thriving community then. Then going down the road, I did Stewart. I did as far south as Carmax. Although I didn't actually have to do Carmax, except every now and again if somebody was away, I had to do Carmax. And then the other way, I did Turnoff from Stewart, Mayo, Elsa, Keno. And they all were visited once a month, at least. So more if the work warranted it. It meant, well, Dawson probably was one of the largest driving areas and used to be an average of about 1,200 miles a month on the car. That was an average. That didn't include, you know, any of your flying that you did. But that was the straight.
If you did that big an area, how many health nurses were there in the rest of the territory? Do you know?
I can remember when I started in public health. There was one nurse in Dawson. There was one nurse in Watson Lake. They just hired a nurse for Haines Junction. I think there were five of us total when I started.
So it was a new organization that was just starting to grow, eh?
It was just starting to really get organized, I think. They just really started to build these health centers, per se. The one at Watson Lake was built around 50, 57, 58. The one at Haines Junction was built 60. Well, these are the original ones. Dawson had had a health center. Probably Dawson had had a health center the longest. And Mayo. There had been one in Mayo, although they had discontinued it prior to my time. They had a house there, apparently, for public health nurses, but they'd never had her occupying it. And they had a doctor in Mayo, though, who was doing most of the public health work, or a lot of it. But Dawson City and Whitehorse were the two main centers now. They were the two main areas for public health. And then Watson Lake came next, and then Haines Junction. And then it mushroomed from there. You know, now you have one just about everywhere.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I look around now and I think, dear God, there's five public health nurses in Whitehorse, and there used to be five of us in the territory, and we thought we were really well off, you know, there's five of us.
What made you come up here?
When I finished training in Montreal in 59, I applied for Moose Factory. I wanted to go north, but I didn't want to go out of my home province, Ontario. And I just wanted something different, a little change of scenery. It was a toss-up between going down to the, Newfoundland with the Red Cross, or joining National Health and Welfare and heading north somewhere. And when I wrote for Moose Factory, I didn't hear from him for the longest while, and then all of a sudden I got a letter back. A friend and I applied, both of us trained together. And we got a letter back saying that they needed nurses in Whitehorse, which we didn't even know where it was. And actually, they were friends of my parents. He was the commissioner here, Fred Collins, at the time, and he was in Whitehorse. So I wrote to him and his wife and said, what's Whitehorse like? And they wrote back and said, come, you know, you've got a second home here if you come, sort of thing. And then they wrote us again, and they said they had one opening immediately for a nurse in the hospital in Whitehorse, and there was two other openings available for, you know, a friend, whichever one chose to go. Drift Pile, which is, I don't know where that is, somewhere in Saskatchewan, I think, in Manitoba. And Hobima, Alberta, which is just 50 miles from Edmonton. So this girl I was coming up here with, there was no way she was going to go to Drift Pile or Hobima, but they promised it would just be on a temporary basis. So she came to Whitehorse in September of 59, and I went to Hobima. And I was to be moved out of there in a month, and then in December, I rode into Edmonton on the bus, and they didn't get me out of Hobima, that was it, I was on the next bus east. And they sent me up to Whitehorse, 9th of December, 59, I finally agreed that maybe they'd hired me for Whitehorse, so they'd send me up here. And I came up to work in the hospital. And I worked in the hospital from December of 59 till January of 61. Well, the end of December anyway. And then the hospital approached me, the administration, and asked me if I would consider going to Watson Lake, because the nurse who was in Watson Lake was really inundated with work. And she had a really big area to cover, and she was on call. There was no doctor in Watson Lake. And she was on call all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Plus, she had all this highway work to do, right from Watson Lake to Whitehorse. She was just, well, she was just worn down to a frazzle. So I went down to Watson Lake in January of 60, and I stayed there till October. And I quit.
Oh.
After that, I couldn't stand it. But mainly because they had promised, well, the nurse that I went down there to relieve, she quit. I stayed down there with her till May. She quit in May. And it was just too much. It was too much even for two people. You know, we had no cleaning women. We had nothing at all. We had this health center with a waiting room and a clinic and an apartment. And we had to do everything, you know. Either one or the other of us, I can remember even I went on a Mercy flight all the way to Edmonton in one of the bush planes one night, you know, and took a patient with a head injury, flew him all the way to Edmonton, and then we got back, and then we got diverted at Fort Nelson, and I had to go back up into the Northwest Territories on another Mercy flight. We brought him all the way to Whitehorse, and I went back down to Watson Lake, having had no sleep in 4 days, and had to go right back on call.
Oh.
You know, so it was just fantastic. They had no conception of what they were asking people to do at all.
Huh.
And see, I was all of 22 years old, so it was too much.
Who was responsible for the service then?
No, it was Northern Health.
Yeah.
Always Northern Health. I never worked for anybody but Northern Health.
Mm.
At least while I was working, you know, for the field services. The hospital and field were both Northern Health.
Oh, the hospital too, that's right.
Yeah.
So did they have much of an administrative structure here? Like they
Oh, yeah. Well, they maybe not as elaborate as they have now, because the zone director was also, he wore three caps, they always said. He was the medical director of the hospital. He was the medical director of the territory. And he was the chief health officer. So he had three jobs, really, which was too much for one person, too. Again, though, you know, you didn't have the elaborate health structure that you have now.
No.
It was all pretty, when you look back, it wasn't haphazard. We thought it was pretty organized at the time, but by today's standards, it was pretty haphazard.
Were there any planes or pilots under contract just to the Northern Health?
Never, ever while I was working for them, and that was starting in 59.
Mm-hmm.
They never at any time had anybody under contract. You always took what you could get at the time.
Mm-hmm. Did that work out all right?
Most of the time. I think actually they've been really, really fortunate here in the territory from what I've ever seen, as far as having planes where you know, mind you, we got to know the pilots, say, and we got a little choosy who we were going to fly with. But I can honestly say that over the 15 years that I've been involved in Northern Health, I think they've had absolutely fantastic service from the pilots, the bush pilots. Just fantastic. You know, I mean, you get pilots that would go to Ross River, and not only did they fly you out there and transport you down to the clinic and this sort of thing, but they stayed and lit the fire for you and helped you out at the clinic and, you know, brought you back to Whitehorse. Well, this was really, and they've always done this. I don't know what it's like right now. I suppose it's a much more business-like arrangement now, but they were really great.
There haven't been any incidents like the Hartwell thing, eh?
Never.
Planes, no.
Never. I don't honestly think. I can't even honestly think. Well, mind you, again, I think it depends on your medical structure from the top down, eh? Medical directors that I've worked for here have been really sensible. And again, the bush pilots that we've flown with here have been pretty sensible types, too. There's a lot of them have been around here for a long time. And their theory is, and I think it's a good one, and I still feel this way, that there's a price you pay for living in an isolated area. And one of the prices that you pay is that if you are living in an isolated area and you take sick, people are going to do the best they can under the circumstances. But if the circumstances mean that you're going to risk three lives for the price of one, you know, in lousy weather or something like this, then you're on your own hook. You know, and I've always felt this way. If it's me and I know the weather's lousy, I don't expect somebody to come looking for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've chosen to do this, therefore I got to get out of this situation the best way I can. Mm-hmm. And we've always had, pretty well always have had medical directors who felt this way too. They weren't going to send anybody out to get a patient in lousy weather. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't, most of the pilots wouldn't go anyway. So it was just an accepted fact, you know. If it was poor weather, you didn't go.
Right.
Sleeping bag in, you had to bend the sleeping bag around the strut in the center of it. And coming back, this was in the winter, and it just seemed to get dark very quickly, and it got very, very rough. And we couldn't come back the way we'd gone in because the weather had deteriorated in over the Sawtooth Mountain Range, so we had to come back via the road, which always took longer. And by the time we got in, I couldn't get back to help the patient because, you know, it was so rough that I can remember this ashtray in the front of the plane, you know, when you hit the air, the rough air, the ashes were flying out of the ashtray. And all I could hear was this woman moaning in the back thinking, you know, dear God, there's just, if I get out, you know, the thing is I'm going to fracture my skull on the roof of the plane. And I'll be no good to her anyway. And at least where she was lying, and we had her tied down so she wasn't bouncing around or anything. But we landed here after dark, and I guess they were pretty concerned that God knows where we were because we were overdue. But that's the only time I've ever, that's really the only time I've ever even been slightly frightened.
What happened to her? Because you said that you thought she was pregnant.
She was. Oh, yeah, she was. She was a placenta previa, too. She delivered about 17 minutes after we got her in.
Oh.
We were just, oh, luck or God or somebody was with us every inch of the way.
She was an Indian woman, I guess.
Yeah. Indian white status woman.
Because there'd be very few white people in Ross at that point, eh?
We had a dispenser there at the time who was the Catholic priest.
Oh, right.
Father Rigo.
Rigo,
yeah. And, of course, Father Rigo was absolutely tremendous. You know, if somebody came in with their hand chopped off, Father Rigo would cope. But if it came to somebody having a baby, Father Rigo was, you know, like most men, absolutely, totally helpless.
Did you deal with Mary Charlie at all?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I trained Mary Charlie.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, she's really nice.
Yeah. Mary Charlie was one of the first people that we sent out on a community health workers course. Mary Charlie Sr., you mean?
Yeah.
The mother and the daughter now,
who's
Dorothy?
Tootsie.
Oh. Well, Tootsie's another daughter.
Oh, okay.
Dorothy is Dorothy, actually.
Dorothy Olson. Right.
That's her daughter.
And Mary was what Dorothy is before, eh? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Mary was originally the community health worker.
Oh.
That's what she was originally trained to do. We had three of them. Now, Mary wasn't the very first class. She was the next class. The very first class that we had when the program was first put into effect was Gertie Tom here in Whitehorse. and Virginia Smarch from Teslin, and then the next class was Mary Charlie. We also had another candidate from Pelly, Sarah Luke. Well, that was the first four, and it's evolved from there.
Was their job the same as it is now?
I don't know what their job description is now. Originally, excuse me, the community health worker was to provide liaison,
right,
an interpreter service, liaison explaining the health services between the public health or between the field nurse and the people.
Right. That's about what it is now.
They were to be, and they were also to teach. They were to act as a teacher, you know, to, when the public health nurse left, they remained in the community and they put into effect what she had taught. Mm. Now, they had a few other jobs wished on them every now and again. They had basic first aid training. So every now and again, they did get used to some extent. Although, we tried to keep the community health worker totally separate from the actual dispenser. You see, all of the communities have either nurse or lay dispensers. Lay dispenser, no medical training. Nurse dispenser, could have been a nursing assistant. Somebody with a certificate in first aid, or an actual nurse who happened to be living in the community. We tried to keep the two categories very separate. It became difficult in some communities, such as Ross River, where maybe if your lay dispenser quit, then your community health worker, by virtue of the fact that she had some training, was resident there, got used as the contact, and people would go to her.
How long did Mary do it for?
Not that long. The one thing that really sticks in my mind about Mary was when we brought her out, she's got a lot of savvy, that woman, in a very quiet way. And unfortunately, at the time, we needed somebody that maybe was a little more voluble. She probably, maybe we didn't appreciate the fact that she was as good a teacher as she was, but the thing was, she couldn't communicate. She communicated well with her own people, but she couldn't communicate back. Mm. And consequently, I don't think she was working for us when I left. That was in 69. I think she may have still been on the payroll sort of thing, but not really functioning as a community health worker. Well, it was an off-on arrangement with Mary.
Because when I was up in Ross River there for a week, and I guess you know Margaret Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I hired her, too.
Mm. Yeah, because Margaret took me over to talk to her because she'd been the midwife now. Was her role as midwife before you came along, too?
Right. Very much so.
Right.
Same thing as the shamans. There was always the shamans in every community.
Right.
That you were well aware who they were. They'd come and sit at your clinic. They'd never acknowledge the fact that they were the shaman. They'd come and sit at your clinic, you know, and you just got to know them after a while. They might or might not come and ask you for something, but they'd come and they'd park, and they'd sit there right through the whole clinic.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they try to get people not to come to clinic?
Never. I never had any trouble with any of them at all. Mm-hmm. Never while I was actually in the community. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't think, I don't ever recall having heard of any of them creating any difficulties after I'd left. They were very much in evidence in two places, to me anyway. One of them being Pelly, and the other one being Ross River.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any trouble with people using, well, it's not really trouble, but it might be frustration, people using Indian medicine rather than yours when you prescribed something?
You always run into this, eh? You know, they'd have boils or carbuncles or something, and they'd use the pitch from the tree,
mm-hmm.
which you'd look at this mucky mess maybe on the back of the neck or something and think, dear God, you know, what do I do now? But to me, and this is what, after I took over in charge of the nurses in the territory, I've always said to them, you know, if it's not getting any worse, then don't ruin it, you know, don't disrupt it, accept it. Only if it's getting worse, maybe suggest that their medicine isn't working as quickly as it could or something like this. And don't you try to fix it up. You're better off, rather than destroy your position in the community, you're better off to try to send them to Whitehorse. Because then if something goes wrong, you can always say, look what Whitehorse did.
Uh-huh.
you know, because if you tried to fix it up and they got them into a bigger mess, then you'd ruined your own position in the community.
Was it a hard position to gain when you first went in?
I think it is for some people. I don't mean this to sound conceited, because God knows there wasn't any greener nurse than I was, but I think that it shows through if you like the work, and if you like the people, and if you're willing to go out of your way maybe a little bit to do things. You know, we always got nurses that would stand around and say, well, I don't drive the government car after 5 o'clock at night, and I don't do this and I don't do that. Well, they would run into trouble because maybe they were right, but they just take a little too firm a line, eh? Whereas the people who went out of their way, I mean you had to be firm in some instances, because there was lots of them that would run you right into the ground. But I think it depended on your approach. I think if you were truthful, if you said to them, well, I don't know, you know, I'm going to do this and I don't really know what's going to happen, but this is what I'm going to do. I always found that there was a remarkable childlike trust there. And, you know, I can remember being at Minto one night, about 8 o'clock at night, visiting a baby there who I considered was critically ill. And I said to the mother, I have to take this baby to Whitehorse tonight. You know, it was pretty cold. And I was by myself in the car. And she didn't say another word. She handed me the baby. You know, to drive that baby 169 miles in below zero weather, sort of, you know, you take it, the baby will get better. Mm. And it was an almost implicit trust. Maybe it was ignorance, eh?
Well, you must really want to work hard to keep that up, too.
You had to work hard. You had to do it. And you had to get there when you said you were going to be there. Mm. I found this, we were supposed to drive, it was 40 below or colder, which is fine, but you know, you might start out somewhere as 30 below, and by the time you got to Gravel Lake or somewhere, it was 50 below. And if you missed a day, or if you were a day late, having sort of already sent your notice that you were going to be in the community on such and such a date, when you got there, it wasn't really teasing, although it did get to be that after a while, but you'd get this attitude, you know, like, where were you? And not really critical, but they were expecting you to be there because you said you were going to be there, and therefore you should be there.
And they'd all made their plans, and
yeah, that's right. You know, and it might be you got down there and everybody was drunk and they didn't show up for the clinic and you had to spend an extra day, but that didn't count. You know,
just if it was the other way.
And I really found that, you know, like when I started down from Dawson to Pelly. When I first started holding clinics in Pelly, for a while I was holding them in the old Anglican Mission. And when I say old Anglican Mission, I mean it was really old. You know, it was log cabin, unheated, this sort of thing. And when I get down there, if they knew I was coming, some of them would have to fire it, the whole bit. The Evelyn, somebody, Ethel Martin. Ethel Martens was a health educator in Ottawa, working for the Department of National Health and Welfare. And this was her brainchild in entirety. And she was the one who started the program, instigated it. They were looking around for recruits when I came back in 65. And I can remember that Gertie Tom was one of the candidates at the time and was being turned down on the basis of the fact that she was living common law with a white man, which they felt would hamper her working with the Indian people because she was supposedly a cut above them, eh? And we really fought to get Gertie into the course, and she turned out to be one of the best ones. So she had it. Excuse me, Gertie had an in though, because she was running on the CBC. She was working for the CBC And she ran the Native Request program on Saturday afternoon. So everybody knew her. And she's still around. I don't know whether anybody's ever mentioned her name to you or not, but she's still around.
Good, okay. Was this all across Canada then? Things that came from the top?
Oh, yeah. See, the first course was held in, I think it was in Hobima, Alberta. It was, too. But I remember I had to go back. That was the first time I'd been back there since I'd worked there in public health. Or I wasn't working in public health, I was working in the little hospital there. But they set that up as their training center. Mm. And Gertie in Virginia. Mm. And a fellow from Old Crow. Pat Dickmeyer would know his name. Uh-huh. You remember the name of the fellow from Old Crow that they hired as one of the first community health workers? Oh, I should know his name as well as anything. There were three of them. There was Gertie in Virginia and this fellow from Old Crow, and they sent them all out on this training course. And then Mary Charlie went on the next one.
Oh, she went outside for that?
Yeah.
They trained them. Oh, they still train them outside. It's Fort Smith, isn't it?
Well, they've changed the location a number of times. The first few were held at Hobima. Now, I think Mary trained at Hobima, too. But I could be wrong there. She may have gone somewhere else. But they changed, I don't know, three or four times. Mm-hmm. They didn't always hold it in the same place. It depended on how many people they had and from where. You see, Northern Region headquarters, go back the other way. Northern Region headquarters were based in Edmonton. And so Hobima was 50 miles from Edmonton, so they could use the resource people from there. And then they drew them in from various places in the north. I think Yellowknife sent one down that time, and Inuvik had one, and I can't remember how many were on the first course, but it runs through my mind there were around a dozen.
How do you think it's worked out?
I think the basic idea was good, and I still think it's good, but the ones that I know of that we trained, well, the fellow didn't work out very well because he had a bit of a drinking problem and he couldn't seem to get trapped, number one. And he maybe was not the best candidate. They had trouble recruiting at the beginning because some of the Native people sort of thought that it would be a cross between gaining elevated status and tattling sort of thing. And then when they did get some decent recruits, they got back to their villages, and the thing that I think that was wrong was that the people that they took out, that they were exposed to a good idea. They saw the idea was good, and they went back, fired up with vigor and vitality, and they couldn't cope with the crunch of reality. You know, they just couldn't cope with the idea that you'd go and tell somebody one day and everything would be going along tremendously well. And the same thing with public health. You go in one day and the kids are being looked after and the house is clean and everything really seems to be doing great. And you walk in the next day and you fall over the wine bottles, you know, and the kids are dirty and sick and this sort of thing. And you're right back to square one.
It must be difficult if you're from within the community, too. You don't want to tell your best friend to smarten up.
Yeah, this is tough. This is what I mean.
Really,
this is where they were really in a pretty awkward position.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't really been in contact with it for the last 4 years. Mm. And I, you know, if I said that I knew what was going on now, it wouldn't be the truth. I don't know.
I talked to Sandra Johnson. She's the White Horse.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And she told me what she was doing.
How does she find it?
Frustrating at times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, they've all found this. Another thing, you know, it doesn't matter which way you turn, you're always running into problems. For instance, Gertie didn't live down in the village. She lived in Moccasin Flat? Yeah, she lived down there behind the ship. That was Moccasin Flat. So, although she was Indian, she wasn't living right in the village. So then, the government, in its usual chintzy fashion, wasted no amount of money training her. But then, how was she going to get around? And it wasn't like all the Indian people lived there. There was some living there, there was some living in town, there was a bunch living in Moccasin Flats at the time, there was some living, we were all over the place. And you don't just walk from A to B, you know, there's just no way. So, of course, they wouldn't give her traveling expenses, and she couldn't very well hire a cab because this elevated her status too. Mm-hmm. She didn't own her own car, and they wouldn't have given her mileage anyway. So we taught her how to drive a government car, only in a last desperate attempt, because we found that, that the nurses were being used as chauffeurs, eh, for the community health workers, which also alienated them, because there was the nurse sort of driving somebody up to the door, dropping her and coming back to get her. But yet when she drove the government car, she immediately became a civil servant.
So all the good intentions get lost somewhere along the line.
They get lost in the most fantastic amount of it's not red tape. It's just the things that, that you never think of.
Yeah, right.
You know, like a stupid little thing like transportation. Another thing was, it was really a problem, was that the BD rate is really high.
What?
So, or you got changing public health nurses.
You
know,
maybe get a health nurse that was, that you'd have a girl's name given to you, say, 10 times in 10 days. But you didn't know her. And you could walk by her on the street 15 times and you wouldn't know her. So it's a community health problem. And your community health worker would help you by maybe say, well, okay, there she is right there. But as soon as she put the finger on the girl, then she became an informant. And then if she professed that, or confessed that she wasn't doing so well with the family, then maybe the public health nurse would go down and try to do something with the family. She was an informant again, you know, so it was mostly public relations. The problems were fantastic.
Yeah, right.
And if you got somebody that was totally acceptable to the people, and they, as I say, like somebody like Mary that was totally acceptable to the community, couldn't communicate with the nurse to save her soul.
Yeah, I think Sandra's probably pretty good for it. She's a Baha'i,
which helps.
Sort of gives her a bit of an edge there, personally, I guess. Thanks.
Well, it would certainly give her an edge with the Baha'is.
Yeah.
You want to drink water or something?
Yeah.
Would
that ice cool?
No, she's married to a white man, too, but I guess that's so common now that it doesn't pose a problem anymore.
It did, only insofar as with Gertie, was that she wasn't married to him, and she was living with him. Plus the fact that she had been married to an Indian, and it was what they call a blanket wedding, and it had been dissolved blanket style sort of thing. She was a Carmax Indian, too.
Yeah, that's something Sandra was saying, because she's Tlingit, and the White Horse Indian Band, when she was hired, got all up in arms and said there should be a White Horse Band that was the health worker.
But see, White Horse Band as White Horse Band didn't really exist until they moved the village, until they moved the people and brought them in here. Like most of the White Horse Band Indians came from the Big Salmon area, which Gertie did. Albeit she was married a man from Carmack, she was originally Big Salmon. And they moved that community down river, upriver, to Whitehorse, you see, and that was one of the communities that came into town. And, they amalgamated it. The Whitehorse was a conglomeration of everything. Teslin, Asiac, what's the other place down the road?
Champagne.
Then they all became White Horse Band, eh? Because, I mean, the bands were just an arbitrary decision. It wasn't like there's any heritage or any...
No, it's just bureaucracy.
It's straight bureaucracy.
Right.
In the same way with the changing of the numbers, it's straight bureaucracy.
Yeah.
But I can see, there's more pride now. I mean, the White Horse Band's been in existence. You know, that's, another 10 years, eh? So there's maybe more pride in the White Horse Band per se, but the White Horse Band were always, to some extent, looked down upon by a lot of the other bands, particularly Tesla, Plinkett, and the Old Crow, and through there, you know, because they were
a motley crew.
Yeah, they were a hodgepodge of everything.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of got moved into town and, you know, went through this process of dissipation faster.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have the respect of the rest of the people. And they, as far as I'm concerned, the White Horse people, the natives from the White Horse Village, were just about the toughest Indians I've ever worked with. Mm. Tough, I don't mean tough. I mean tough in that it just seemed you never made any progress. You know, I think the frustrations were greater here than they were anywhere else. At least in Pelly, at least in Dawson, you could predict that these 3 days, there comes the family welfare check, or the baby bonus, or the family allowance. There's the wood-cutting money, like Indian Affairs would say, well, I just paid everybody their wood-cutting money, so you think, okay, there's no point in me trying to do anything for 2 days, eh? So forget it, don't even go to visit them. And then when they spent the money and they were becoming sad, sorry, sober again, you went back and started again, picked up the pieces. But for 2 days, family allowance day, or whenever they got paid off their job or anything like that, there was just no point. But see, with the Indians here in Whitehorse, everything was very handy. They could go to Indian Affairs, get their money pretty well anytime, or they could always pick up work, okay, for a couple of days. And it wasn't just that you could predict that maybe 3 days of the month everybody would be drunk. You could predict here that 30 days of the month, 50% of the people would be drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So it was even more frustrating here. And I think if you asked any of the nurses that have worked in various places around the territory, they'd tell you the same thing.
I guess it's the same now, too, eh?
I would think so. And they're harder to track down, eh? In a small village or a small town. They've got to be one of two places, one
Everybody
of three.
Knows.
They're at home, they're on the trap line, or they're in the beer parlor.
Mm.
So if they're in the trap line, their cabin's all locked. If their cabin is semi-locked up sort of thing, their dogs are still there, they're in the beer parlor. If they're not there, they're home.
They're home, yeah, right.
So it's easy to deliver the care. But here, I mean, to deliver the care, to even find them, to say to do a tuberculin test or anything, like, God, but you can spend weeks tracking.
The prenatal care, when you were working up in St. Pelly, did you find the Indian women came into you regularly?
Mm-hmm.
They did, eh? By that time, I guess they'd been educated too, eh?
Pretty well. It's because it depended on you, too, eh? As I say, if you had somebody that, you could really tease them. You couldn't give them hell. You might be furiously mad at them because they were neglecting themselves so horribly. And maybe some days it would hit you the wrong way and you'd think, you know. But if you could, they like to be teased. They like to be, in their own way, they like to be included in the joke, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So you could do a lot this way. You know, never, you couldn't. It's hard to explain, really, but
sort of cajole.
You could give them hell in a friendly, nice way that maybe they knew that you were cross at them, but not so cross that you weren't going to, you know, continue on caring for them.
Mm.
And I think this makes a lot of difference.
And did they come into Whitehorse to have their babies?
Not always. Most of the natives from Pali went to Mayo.
Oh, right.
Whitehorse, if it was going to be something really complicated.
Do many Indian women have cesareans? I wouldn't imagine so.
No. Very few. More now, I suppose. You know, again, it's better prenatal care, so better prenatal care, bigger babies.
Mm.
Plus, they're not living. You know, I can still remember going and doing a prenatal visit on a girl up, this was up at out of Beaver Creek, and we had to walk into White River Johnny's trapline cabin. Well, actually, it was his father who was quite ill, but this girl was probably 8.5 months pregnant, maybe. And we were walking along this path, and it was a 3-mile hike from the side of the road into the trapline cabin. And the Indian path, a 1 foot straight ahead of the other, it's about this wide, and we were just floundering, Iris, Crandall, and I. absolutely floundering along this path, both supposedly in really good physical condition. This girl, 8.5 months pregnant, you know, had to keep stomping so I could catch up. Just fantastic physical and stamina. And she was really big. You know, she was going to obviously have a great big baby. I'll never forget. She carried the bag in for us.
No.
Because we just couldn't keep our footing. After I dumped it about the fourth time, she made me give it to her.
That must be inbred though, eh? Because they had to work so hard in the old days.
Well, physical labor. I mean, you know yourself, you go out to the bush for the weekend. There's a lot of pleasure. You're out communing with nature and this sort of thing. It's a lot of work just to live. So I think that they lived in the bush and they, you know, there were no chairs, say, so they squat at the campfire. Good, that's a perfect position.
Yeah, right. What about the kids? Were there much scabies and things, communicable things like that?
Not so much in the bush. I always found them healthier in the bush, where even if water was lacking, you know, so they were dirty and they were covered with mosquito bites and this sort of thing, but they were always healthier. But there was a lot of the diseases like scabies, lice, lots and lots and lots of lice. Still is lots and lots and lots of lice.
Do you know anything about the sweat hogs they used to have in some places? Did you ever come across
Yeah, I did. I came across one. Well, it must have been in Cali. That was in Cali. Yeah, but they were old. You know, this one wasn't even being used. Although, interestingly enough, I can still remember the Indians in Cali telling me about this fantastic hot springs where they all used to go. And it's not been one that has ever been developed or anything. That's good country for hot springs up through there. It's apparently up towards Ethel Lake between Dawson and Stewart. And they used to all go in there once a year. It was almost like a migration in there to the water they considered was healing water. And
sort of religious thing?
No.
It wasn't a purification ritual?
No, it didn't seem to be. It just seemed to be more on the nature of, it was just good for them. They just went because it made them feel good.
And everybody went at one time? It was a big
gathering? No, but they used to talk about going, you know, and even the ones that they didn't make it there that year, they sort of look for, you know, the same way as they go out to their fish camps, to their hunting camps, to the wood camp. They always were going to camps. And if they were at their camps, you drive along the highway, and the way you could tell where the camp was, they'd have a stick up on the side of the road with a mitten, a thumb would point towards the path. And this is how you used to tell, you know, where the camp was. Mind you, they never had written on the mitt how far it was into the dark thing.
And did you go to the camps then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I checked the camps out. Not routinely, but certainly if I knew, you know, again, there was good liaison, and if you had a baby, say, that was born in Whitehorse that they considered high risk, we got word, that this baby was high risk. So if you went to the village and the family had gone out to the fish camp or to the hunting camp or whatever, or to the trap line camp, and they'd taken this baby with them, then to me it became, part of my responsibility to go and check on my baby. Because, you know, facilities there would be pretty limited. If there was anything wrong, quite often, there'd even know, if they knew you were coming, and they knew approximately when in the month you were coming, say I went to Cali the third week of every month, they'd maybe leave a note out by the mitt, nurse, please come.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then you'd know that there was something wrong.
Would you say they ate better then than now? Out in the bush, with the protein, high protein diet.
Yeah, I would say they did.